TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis, How Capitalism Works and How It Fails. Talking to my daughter about the economy. Yanis Varoufakis was already an internationally known economist and academic when he was elected to the Greek Parliament as a member of the Syriza Party. He served as Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He resigned when Syriza broke its promise to significantly curtail the austerity measures which had led to the longest recession in post-war history. Varoufakis led negotiations with Greece's creditors during this government debt crisis. However, he failed to reach an agreement with them. This led to the 2015 Greek bailout referendum. Varoufakis criticized the troika of Greece's lenders, the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission. They insisted on bailout loans. Varoufakis said that this was a transfer of losses from private banks to Greece's and Europe's taxpayers. Another bailout. Yanis Varoufakis is the author of many books in international distribution, among them his most recent, Talking to My Daughter About the Economy, and Adults in the Room, My Battle with Europe's Deep Establishment, and The Global Minotaur, America, the True Causes of the Financial Crisis, and the Future of the World Economy. He spoke at Town Hall at the University Temple United Methodist Church in Seattle, Washington, on May 15, 2018. Here is Yanis Varoufakis.
Thank you to Seattle Town Hall. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here tonight. And when I hear that there is this boisterous dialogue regarding how to treat corporations like Amazon who want to move into this city, the first thought that occurs to me is that it's all not about the economy, really. It's about a kind of social ecology. Because think about it. Why do corporations want to come to this splendid city? It's because of the community that you have created. This is what they seek in Seattle. The quality of the human condition that your community has created. Now, when a company like Amazon wants, however, to move here to enjoy this community, like humanity has done so many times before, we operate like stupid viruses, invading an organism which we're killing. The organism, the very organism that we want to inhabit, we're killing it. This is what we're doing to the planet. This is the effect of us and our thoughtless, profit-maximizing, individualistic activity on our planet. This is what corporations do. They move into a new territory, like Europeans did in Africa, in Asia, here, in Australia, in New Zealand, colonize it, and then suddenly we realize that we've destroyed the very environment which drew us to this place. And the only defense to this is collective action. It is democracy. It is for the people of this community to stand up and to say, look, to the Amazons of the world, we need to preserve this community. And you need to pay taxes. I know you don't want to pay taxes. But, you know, as Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, I like paying taxes because they buy me civilization. The problem with corporate logic is that it does not understand civilization. Corporatism and civilization are two alien forces. And the only thing that can bring some kind of detente between corporate logic and economic and environmental and communitarian sustainability is the democratic process, making them pay, for instance. I'm not saying that the head tax is the best way of doing it. It would be much preferable if we could actually tax their profits directly. But given that they always hide their profits in some tax haven somewhere, you have to start somewhere. We can quibble about whether you should tax property, make them pay higher rents, whether they should pay head tax, and so on and so forth. Anyway, you can see that I have been immersed in this debate because my minders took me to an NPR today to be interviewed about the book that brings me to town. That reminded me that it really doesn't matter what you talk about. Whatever you talk about, you go back to the same issue, which is the fragility of communities, the fragility of democracy. Democracy is the most fragile of flowers, and it is constantly being trampled upon. Now, what we also forget is that democracy is something that is absolutely, deeply despised by the powerful. Indeed, speaking as an Athenian for a moment, all the great Athenians that you know of yesteryear, like Plato, Aristotle, they loathed democracy. Plato wrote The Republic as a treatise against democracy. He was calling it ochlocracy, which means in Greek something like mob rule. Aristotle actually, he gave us a splendid definition of democracy while being an anti-democrat himself. He said it is a system of government where the many, who are by definition the poor, control government. Reconceptualize democracy like this, you realize that we really never had democracy in the West, ever. The many and the poor never controlled government. Indeed, the whole point of the American Constitution, the very point of the German Constitution, of the French Constitution, the Greek Constitution, the whole point of our so-called liberal democratic constitutions was how to keep the demos out of democracy, how to ensure that the people would never be in power, that they would be consulted, that they would be made to feel that they somehow control government without controlling it. If you read the Federalist Papers, it's explicit. It's all about checks and balances, where checks and balances are not meant in order to keep, you know, the executive from trampling our rights or the rights of the judiciary to be independent. No, it was all about how to make sure that the property rights of the 1% are maintained against a mob that might get the crazy idea in its head about the redistribution of property rights over wealth and assets. When people talk to me about China these days, they say, oh, it's so anti-democratic. Yeah, well, what was the West? Remember, capitalism grew up in the 19th century in this country, but also in Europe, with the exception of England and parts of Scotland, where it had already started emerging at the end of the 18th century. Let me remind you that in the 19th century, liberalism was defined as the ideology that would be powerfully competing against the idea of democracy. Even somebody as liberal and a wonderful person, a fantastic philosopher, very good writer, defender of women's rights, John Stuart Mill, the archetypal liberal, was an anti-democrat. He believed that democracy was an awful system of government. And he did not encourage one person, one vote, ever. He was actually fighting against it. So liberalism was juxtaposed against democracy. And it was only the great financial crisis that began in the 1840s and then were turbocharged in the 1880s. And then immediately after that, the turn of the century, the next financial crisis, which in the first decade of the 20th century gave you the Federal Reserve. And then after that, 1929, it was only these processes activated by financial collapses that created effectively a good press for the word democracy. Effectively, what I'm saying is that democracy has many enemies. If we ever get a chance of a democratic decision-making process, either at the level of the town hall, or the level of our state, the level of our federal government, we must count ourselves lucky, because there are so very few points in the history, in our collective history, when we actually had something resembling democracy. I mentioned that when I was in government in 2015, I was struck by two things that I heard being said by rather powerful men. And of course, they were men. They were not women. It's quite one thing to imagine that this is what powerful men say to one another. It's quite another to actually hear it with your own ears. Quite educational. And the two men that I'm referring to, one was Barack Obama, and the other was Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister. I remember when I met Barack Obama in the White House, he was actually extremely nice and very encouraging on a personal basis. First thing he said, and took me aback with that, he said, look, you're right in your analysis. I was right in my analysis about the Greek debt and how it had to be cut and restructured, and that austerity in my country had gone far too far. But you've got to compromise, because, you know, there are very few degrees of freedom in this world. I said, Mr. President, I wake up in the morning and go to bed at night dreaming of compromise, but I'm not going to be compromised. There's a fundamental difference between the two. And he smiled, and he said, look, when I was elected, after my inauguration, I was completely helpless. I had to bail out Wall Street. He actually used a term that was very unpresidential. He said, those bastards in Wall Street. And it was like drinking a glass of political poison. That was the word that he used, the phrase he used. So he was presenting himself, think about it, the most powerful man in the world, talking to the most bankrupt minister of finance of the most devastated and insolvent bankrupt state in the world. And he's presenting himself to me as powerless, effectively saying that the democratic mandate he had just received in 2008 meant nothing because he had to do what he had to do, which is to, you know, employ and deploy massive socialism for the bankers while throwing the majority of the people of this country into the Roman arena of unfettered market forces. That's what he was saying. He didn't say it in those terms, but that's what he meant. And he was inviting me to be compromised as well. That was my interpretation. But he was extremely nice about it. That's the difference between the current president and the previous president. But I doubt that there is much difference when it comes to actual policies on the ground. There are some, but much less than you think they are. The other man was Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, who actually was an education for me. The finance minister of the richest European country, a country that has a quadrillion surplus with the United States of America, with China, with the rest of Europe, with the rest of the world. And by the end of our relationship, I saw this man go to pieces. Why? We had these fierce conversations and confrontations, but nevertheless, I realized that he knew that what he was doing in the end was wrong by his people, by my people, and by the people of Europe. And when I said to him, I pushed him, and to his credit, he admitted it. And I said to him, so what are we going to do, Wolfgang? We have been elected, we have a mandate, a democratic mandate, to do things differently from this. Do you know what he did? He shrugged his shoulders, and he, not happily, not condescendingly, but very, very unhappily. I would call him depressed at that moment. So, you know, I wrote this book speaking to my daughter about the economy. I was simply trying to organize my own thoughts, because if you cannot understand, explain the economy to a teenager in a language that everybody understands, then you're not understanding it yourself. We have a moral and political duty to empower ourselves and our children to speak authoritatively about the economy. And the reason for that is that in the world we live, the economy penetrates every dimension of life, whether it's the head tax in Seattle, the schooling system, the health service, what's happening in Syria today, the relationship between the United States, Europe, and China, climate change, everything goes through this, if you want, panopticon of what's called the economy. It would be a tragedy for democracy. Plato will have won his greatest victory, crushing the fragile flower of democracy, if we all, and my daughter, are convinced by the establishment, by the powers that be, by the economics profession, by finance ministers and so on, by the International Monetary Fund, by the Federal Reserve, that we better leave the matters of the economy to the experts, to the economists. See, I have no problem with experts. But the economy is not like civil engineering projects. The economy is society. It's you and me. It is everything. It's easy to mistake economics, the study of the economy, for a science. It has a jargon that is as impenetrable as any good book on thermodynamics to somebody who doesn't know physics. Very much like the process which yields everyday weather forecasts. How are weather forecasts produced? You have a mathematical model of the weather system. It's inside the computer. The computer is connected to various implements that measure wind temperature, wind direction, water temperature, air pressure, satellite data, and so on. All this empirical data is fed into the computer. The mathematical model is there. Boom, comes the forecast. Now, why can't we say the same thing about finance, the economy? You have huge quantities of data now, microeconomic data, data on what every consumer does, especially now that we have Facebook and Google and so on, and Amazon. You have data on interest rates from all over the world, exchange rates, share prices, bond prices, derivative prices. Oh, capitalism produces even more data than nature does. It goes in there, and out comes the forecast. I'll tell you what the difference is. Profound difference between the two. In the case of meteorology and physics, nature doesn't give a damn about our theories regarding nature. So whatever our forecast will be about the weather tomorrow in Seattle, the weather in Seattle will be whatever it would have been independently of our forecasts about the weather in Seattle. Yes? Which is fantastic for a physicist and a meteorologist, because it means that the weather is an objective judge, an objective arbiter of our theories about the weather. If the theory is stupid and the prediction is dumb, the weather will tell you so. And, you know, eventually, through a process of Darwinian selection, the bad meteorologists will be weeded out and the good ones will survive and their models and mathematics will prevail. But imagine for a second, just for a second, that I am renowned, I said imagine, okay? We economists can assume anything. So for a moment, be economy. Imagine that I am a renowned financial expert who has predicted every stock exchange crash in the last 30 years. A small aside, no financial crash has ever been predicted by anyone except by chance. Yeah? Remember 2008? Who predicted it? No one. I had written something about the crash coming, and of course, I had no idea what I was saying. People would say, yeah, but you would say that. You're a lefty. You always predict the crash of capitalism. You know, a stopped clock is correct twice a day. But for a moment, imagine that I am this guru of the financial markets that has predicted everything. Whenever there was a downswing, I predicted it. And let's imagine that after this event tonight, we go out, some of us, and I have a couple of beers, or six. And I go back to my hotel, downtown Seattle, and out, as a prank, I tweet that tomorrow, Nasdaq, or the Wall Street Stock Exchange, is going to collapse. Do you know what's going to happen? It will collapse. Because people believe me. Yeah? Even if I did it as a joke, it will happen. I can give you examples where you can have a fantastic theory, which its prediction does not materialize only because it became known. So that's the opposite. A good theory which is violated by the facts because it was good. And a bad theory, a drunken theory, which was confirmed just because it was made public. So you see the difference? Nature doesn't give a damn about our predictions, but society is our predictions. Because society is what you and I do. And what you and I do depends on what you and I believe. So if we believe something, and suddenly we change with our belief, that belief, the change in belief, feeds into a different social and economic outcome. So the phenomenon that we are studying as economists is intertwined, inextricably linked to our own theories about it. So economics is part of the phenomenon it tries to explain. So we like, you know, a cat chasing its own tail. That's why it can never be a science. Ever. Anybody who tells you economics is a science is either a fool or is trying to fool you. There is no third option. And proof of that is, of course, economists have never predicted any significant economic event in the history of capitalism, and never will. Therefore, if there are no experts and economics is not a science, what do we do? We need each one of us to become able to tackle economic questions with a degree of authority. That means we have a political and moral duty to become acquainted with the ways of capitalism, this is the system, the economic system we live in, so as to prevent the economists from fooling us about how capitalism works. Economists are not bad people, they're not fooling us on purpose. They need to fool themselves in order to do what they're doing. Because, you know, it's a very boring life. And the only way of maintaining this process of pseudoscience is by convincing yourself that what you're doing is science. So treat them with humility, with empathy, with sympathy, you know, like lost children. We are in a church. Treat them in a Christian way. Eh? They need your support. But what you don't need is them to convince you that they know what is the answer to the head tax, to Donald Trump's tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, to the questions about climate change. You are as much of an expert as anyone else. And this is the beauty of democracy. And here's how I'm going to leave you. Look, what we must understand is the evolution, the history of that has led to the societies in which we find ourselves. Allow me to try to put it in 3 minutes. Once upon a time, power was one sphere, one realm. The lord of the land, the baron, the king, in medieval Europe, let's say, had all the power. He was military, and because he could conjure up military power, he had political power, and that meant he was rich, which means he also had economic power. Capitalism ruptured this unitary realm of power, split it into two different realms, the political and the economic. Before that, the word economic didn't mean anything. It's no great wonder that, you know, Harvard University, when it was set up, Cambridge University in Britain, you know, all the great universities in the world, didn't even consider having an economics department back then. The word economics did not exist. The word economy didn't mean anything. When the ancient Greeks talked about economics, the Greek word, oikos means home. It means home economics. It means how to manage your household. It's got nothing to do with what we refer to as economics. But what happened was the eviction of the peasants in England and Scotland, which was necessary to replace them with sheep because their wool, the sheep's wool, was valuable in the new international trade routes that had been established due to advances in navigation and shipping. Suddenly, those 70% of the peasants were evicted within 40 years in Britain. Can you imagine that? They had nowhere to go. Suddenly, all this labor is extracted from the land, and they have to knock on doors in nearby villages and say, I will do anything for a loaf of bread. That's the first labor market. It's the first time in human history when people are actually selling their labor, selling it. It becomes commodified. And immediately, land became a commodity because suddenly we knew how much it was worth, every acre, because we knew how much wool it could grow. And the price of wool was determined internationally. So you throw into this mix Charles Watt's fantastic invention, the steam engine, you have the first factory. But suddenly you have a new social class, which is neither peasants nor landlords, that have something called financial power or economic power. So for the first time in human history, the world of political power, the realm of political power and the realm of economic power are split. The merchants and the factory owners suddenly begin to have power, money, that the king didn't have anymore. More recently, we had another split. The economic sphere was dissected, divided, and multiplied again between industrial power and financial power. So the banker acquired power, and not at the Edison, the Henry Ford of the world. So this is what has been happening. And as we are now in a world where the financial realm controls our lives, industrial power is second, and the political sphere has lost all power, democracy is confined to the least powerful sphere, to the political sphere, and this is why this fragile flower is being crushed. If you start thinking in those terms, and then start applying very basic ideas about, you know, how debt fuels profits. So debt is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Unpleasant, but absolutely essential for capitalism. And how the control of financial power by the bankers makes them effectively masters of the universe, because if their bets succeed, they become stinking rich. If they fail, you bail them out. Yeah? So if you start thinking in those terms, it's not difficult very quickly to acquire an economic expertise, which, if you do acquire it, then democracy has a chance. Thank you very much.
You heard the talk, How Capitalism Works and How It Fails, by Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and a co-founder of the international grassroots Democracy in Europe movement 2025. He is the author of the international bestseller Adults in the Room and the global minotaur America, the True Causes of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. After teaching for many years in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, he's currently professor of economics at the University of Athens. Thanks to Mike McCormick, he recorded Yanis Varoufakis at Seattle Town Hall on May 15, 2018. You can find Mike's one-hour-plus video of the event on YouTube under Talking Stick TV. Come back for part two of this program when Yanis Varoufakis engages with the audience and answers questions. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.